Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Certains pensent que le métavers n'est qu'un monde virtuel. Mais un jour, les pompiers utiliseront la réalité augmentée pour s'orienter plus rapidement dans des bâtiments en feu et gagner de précieuses secondes quand des vies seront en jeu. Les médecins utiliseront le métavers pour voir les scanners et prendre des décisions plus vite aux urgences. Et même si les mammouths laineux ont disparu, les élèves pourront retourner à la période glaciaire dans le métavers pour leur rendre visite. Même si le métavers est virtuel, son impact sera réel. Certains pensent que le métavers n'est qu'un monde virtuel. Mais un jour, les pompiers utiliseront la réalité augmentée pour s'orienter plus rapidement dans des bâtiments en feu et gagner de précieuses secondes quand des vies seront en jeu. Les médecins utiliseront le métavers pour voir les scanners et prendre des décisions plus vite aux urgences. Et même si les mammouths laineux ont disparu, les élèves pourront retourner à la période glaciaire dans le métavers pour leur rendre visite. Même si le métavers est virtuel, son impact sera réel.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Monday, the 24th of April, these are our main stories. Governments race to get their staff out of Sudan, with many other foreigners and locals left behind amid urban warfare and food shortages. A rare electoral success for a right-wing party in the German capital, Berlin. And scientists in Chile warn that bird flu has joined the list of threats to one of the rarest dolphins in the world.
We have to protect and care for this species, which is unique, but also very fragile because there are so very few left.
Also in this podcast, Serbs largely refuse to turn out for elections in northern Kosovo due to tensions with ethnic Albanians. And tens of thousands take part in the London Marathon. Western nations and Saudi Arabia have been rushing to get their citizens out of the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. But the fighting between two rival generals, which has taken the lives of 400 people since it started 9 days ago, shows no signs of ending, leaving many people trapped. Some foreigners have decided they're not going to wait for their government to rescue them, such as William, who's British and has been living in Khartoum. He's on a bus with more than 60 other people heading to the Egyptian border.
We've had absolutely nothing but nonsense from the government. Not even nonsense. We've had nothing. The last communication was that the government itself is going to do nothing, the Foreign Office. And so we had to take this option because it was becoming intolerable.
Among those getting out of Sudan with the help of their government are staff at embassies and workers with international agencies such as the UN, who are leaving by road, sea and air. The UK said that its operation in Khartoum to rescue diplomats and their families, which involved UK armed forces, was difficult, dangerous and precarious. Many foreigners are staying put, waiting for advice. Lawrence, a drama teacher from the Philippines, is hoping his government will provide a route out.
We are actually in touch with our Department of Foreign Affairs in Manila and also the Philippine Embassy in Cairo. They're actually monitoring the situation. They're actually planning steps already how to repatriate the Filipinos here in Khartoum. This is my ninth year in Sudan. And I mean, it breaks my heart what's happening now in the country. My wife actually cried this morning. I mean, this is not how we want to end my career in international teaching.
And it appears that Lawrence's story isn't unique. Many people from Asian and African countries are struggling to find a way out of Sudan. There are 5,500 Nigerians there, most of them students. Our correspondent Mercy Juma has been monitoring developments from Nairobi and asked her what advice is being given to foreign nationals.
I think the most uncertainty, for the lack of a better word, comes for foreign nationals who have been left behind while the diplomats from their countries have been, you know, evacuated. And the question many of them are asking, so what next? They're being told to shelter in place, to just keep checking with their embassies, but nobody's really telling them when, how, or where they will be evacuated from. And, you know, it's a really, really difficult situation, keeping in mind that it's been almost 7-8 days without them accessing markets, shops. So food supplies are going down. They don't have water. Some of them have been in darkness without power for many days. Their phones are going off. And on Sunday morning, there were reports that the internet was partially shut in Sudan. So really, really difficult circumstances for people to just sit and wait with no really, you know, a sight to how things will end up for them.
And this race to get people out of Sudan, really a sign of the breakdown of society that's happening.
Indeed. And, you know, many people have been questioning, especially the Sudanese themselves, that this race to get other nationals out of Sudan, you know, people have been pushing for a ceasefire. All the international organizations, you know, other countries have been pushing for a ceasefire. And the question is, was this ceasefire just to allow for evacuations to be done and not really much emphasis on humanitarian assistance? Because that is what the people who are remaining in Sudan need at the moment. They need to get to health facilities. There are thousands who are injured that are not able to access medical aid. They need food. So some people are looking at it as a way for the who is who to be able to get out. Because even if you look at it on the other side, for countries that are from the global south or nationals who are from African countries, nothing much is being said about them. There are no embassies like the Nigerian, Somali embassies that are really going for their people. It's only the USA's, the Japan's, the Germany's, you know, the big countries that are going for their people. So really a clear distinction in the face of a conflict or a war.
As you say, it's the Sudanese and the others who are left behind who are paying the price. And this is all because of a power struggle between essentially two rival generals from two different factions of the military. Are there any reasons to think that this could be coming to an end?
Unfortunately, no. And it's something that's really difficult to predict because thrice they have called for a ceasefire, thrice the ceasefire has failed. We are seeing a lot of accusations on both sides when it comes to attacks. You know, they are accusing each other of attacking convoys that are evacuating people. They are accusing each other of attacking areas that are heavy with civilian populations. So there's a lot of back and forth between the two. And unfortunately, we are not seeing any progress as to them hitting calls or everything that has been asked for them to do, and that is to cease fire and most importantly for them to sit down in dialogue. So unfortunately, the end may not be in sight as soon as everybody is hoping for.
Mercy Juma. Sudan's immediate prospects then appear to be dire. Three attempts to broker a temporary ceasefire have come to nothing as the nation marked the major religious holiday of Eid al-Fitr, the festival marking the end of the month of Ramadan. The BBC's Maini Jones has been speaking to some of the people in Sudan caught up in the mayhem.
Across Sudan, people have had to adjust their plans for Eid.
People are talking about locking themselves at home.
Mohamed Abdullah is a medicine graduate. He was looking forward to starting his first job as a doctor when the war broke out.
It's a wake-up call to see and realize how futile and how seemingly pointless these wars could be. They've impaired the lives of a whole nation over a power struggle that it's not worth it, and it's so sad that we have to suffer.
The country's military head of state, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, admitted in a TV address that this Eid was coming at a difficult time for the people of Sudan. But both him and Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who heads the Rapid Support Forces, have ignored several calls for a ceasefire. It's forced people like Mohamed and his family to risk their lives trying to escape under gunfire.
By the fourth day or fifth day, there was no water for anything. Every morning we would wake up to the sounds of bullets coming through the windows. We could not stay any longer.
Hi.
Have you got time to speak now?
Yes, but like there are bombs everywhere.
Dr. Nidal Bashir is a surgeon based in Khartoum.
A lot of people are trapped in their houses without medical care. But unfortunately, we cannot get to these people because there are no safe ways for doctors. A lot of people are killed in the hospitals because they're actually bombings. And there, a lot of hospitals in Sudan are mainly located in downtown Khartoum, and that's where most of the strikes are.
Footage obtained by the BBC from a hospital in Al-Fashir in northern Darfur shows hundreds of people waiting for medical care. Some are bandaged and bleeding heavily. The United Nations warns that Sudan's healthcare system could completely collapse. It also says more and more people are running out of food and vital supplies. Almost exactly 4 years ago, Sudan's long-term dictator Omar al-Bashir was overthrown following protests by the country's youth. The demonstrations were initially violently repressed by the army. Hajid Usam was just 19 years old at the time.
The fact that it's happening again is just really disappointing. There's just the feeling of being fed up because it just feels like my life is constantly on pause. All that we want is just peace and just things to be normal. That's all we want.
Now Dr. Nidal tells me she may not have a future in her country.
I think we're going to have to move from Sudan if the situation is not improved. I have done a lot of exams that may help me get a job as a doctor in the United Kingdom.
It's a sentiment echoed by many other young people I've spoken to. A brain drain Sudan cannot afford.
Maini Jones with that report. Berlin, the capital of Germany, has traditionally been run by the centre-left SPD party, but no longer. Members of the SPD have narrowly voted to go into coalition with the centre-right Christian Democrats as the junior partner. A new CDU mayor is expected to be sworn in later this week. From Berlin, here's Damian McGuinness.
This will be the first time in decades that Berlin will be run by a conservative-led government. A left-wing Green Party coalition was pushed out in an election rerun in February. The state election of 2021 had been declared invalid by judges because of irregularities, and the vote had to be held again. A housing shortage in Berlin, stretched public services, as well as the botched election, have left voters disenchanted. And even though the centre-left SPD party will stay in government as a junior partner, left-wing party members are outraged, accusing their leaders of selling out. Conservatives, meanwhile, will be hoping that this is the start of a conservative wave and that their success in Berlin can be repeated in other regional elections this year and on a national level in 2 years' time.
Damian McGuinness. The Kosovo war between ethnic Albanians and Serbs may have been over 2 decades ago, but tensions between the two groups remain unresolved. For the past few years, Kosovo has been holding EU-mediated talks with Serbia to normalise relations, but deep divisions remain. Sunday's boycotting of elections in 4 majority Serb areas are another sign of that. Our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay gave me an update on the vote.
Well, it's all over, and it's, let's say, a little bit sluggish, I would say, because the Central Election Commission says that out of the 45,000 people who were registered to vote, only about 1,500 of them turned out, so that's a turnout of 3.5% across the 4 municipalities of North Kosovo. I think it's reasonable to say that this boycott by both ethnic Serb parties and ethnic Serb voters has been successful, although, you know, the whole affair really has not reflected well, I don't think, on any party involved, or indeed not involved.
Why have these elections been so controversial?
Well, the elections were staged in the first place because of the en masse resignation of mayors in North Kosovo last year, and this was due to a dispute, I think you could broadly say, about the rights of ethnic Serbs in Kosovo. In this particular case, it was all to do with vehicle number plates. The extraordinary elections were called originally for December. They were put back because ethnic Serb party said they were boycott, rescheduled for today. And again, the ethnic Serbs are saying they're boycotting this time because they're upset that Kosovo hasn't established a community of ethnic Serb municipalities. So it's clear that ethnic Serbs in North Kosovo are not happy with the authorities in Pristina and don't want to cooperate with their electoral processes. By going ahead with these elections, it's obviously contributing to more distrust and tension between the communities of ethnic Serbs, ethnic Albanians, the government in Pristina, and Serbia's government in Belgrade.
So what kind of autonomy do the ethnic Serbs want, and why is the Kosovo government so resistant?
It's an interesting one, this, because Kosovo actually agreed to set up an association of majority Serb municipalities under the Brussels Agreement in 2013. And this was reaffirmed in 2015. And according to that agreement, what would happen would be a community of Serb municipalities would have a full overview power in the areas of economic development, education, health, urban and rural planning. And that's what ethnic Serbs in Kosovo want. They say they were promised this, and they should be delivered it.
How's it going to be resolved?
Well, the EU and the United States have both been putting Pristina and Belgrade under heavy manners to normalise their relations, especially because of the war in Ukraine. It's alerted the EU and US to the fact that you really don't want frozen conflicts in Europe, or indeed opportunities for Russia to meddle. But this latest dispute between the two sides has come just a month after they supposedly came to an agreement to normalise their relations. So I think it's time for a rethink in both Washington and Brussels.
Guy Delaunay. Scientists in Chile are warning that pollution, industrial activity and now bird flu are endangering one of the world's rarest types of dolphin. There are thought to be fewer than 5,000 Chilean dolphins left, and they are only found off the coast of the South American country. Tim Allman reports.
They are amongst the world's most beloved and most endangered animals. The Chilean, or black dolphin, has coexisted with mankind for thousands of years. A relationship that has always been a little uneasy, now more than ever, according to José Luis Brito from the San Antonio Natural History Museum.
People find them stranded on the beaches, sometimes entangled in the nets and sometimes killed by pollution, by consuming plastic or other harmful products. The Chilean dolphin is disappearing at an alarming rate.
The black dolphin is found in waters off Chile's southern and central coast. But that stretch of the South Pacific is also a popular area for fishing and seaweed extraction. As the country's economic activity expands, the threat to the dolphins also grows, says academic veterinarian Cayetano Espinosa.
We share spaces between the humans and the Chilean dolphin, and knowing this, we have to protect and care for this species, which is unique, but also very fragile because there are so very few left.
Environmental and conservation groups are doing what they can to monitor and protect these vulnerable animals, but their plight is ever more desperate. The black dolphin is only found in Chile. The fear is, soon enough, it won't be found anywhere.
Tim Allman. Still to come. Why crying babies are the main attraction at an ancient festival in Japan. Ukraine's military says Bakhmut and Mariinka in the eastern region of Donetsk are currently seeing the fiercest fighting on the front lines. It said in both towns, Ukrainian forces have repelled further attacks by Russian forces who've been trying to capture them. Other towns in the area, including Avdiivka, are also seeing intense attritional fighting. In Russia itself, the authorities continue to intensify their crackdown on any opposition voices. That even extends to the cultural sphere, as BBC Monitoring's Russia editor Vitaly Shevchenko reports.
This is Andrei Makarevich, one of the best-known performers to have fallen into disfavour after criticising government policies in Vladimir Putin's Russia. State TV once called him a beetle of perestroika, referring to Mikhail Gorbachev's wide-ranging programme of reforms. And in 2003, Makarevich sat right next to Putin at a concert given by Paul McCartney in Red Square. But over time, Makarevich grew increasingly more critical of Vladimir Putin, and after Russia's first invasion of Ukraine in 2014, he attended anti-war rallies and wrote a song called My Country Has Gone Mad.
Моя страна сошла с ума, и я ничем не могу помочь.
After this, a string of his concerts across Russia were cancelled, and Makarevich accused the Kremlin of orchestrating a campaign of persecution. Following the start of the full-scale war in February 2022, Makarevich left Russia a deeply disillusioned man. People have turned out to be much easier to manipulate, more ignorant and aggressive, he said in an interview. Nikolai Rostorguyev, on the other hand, is an example of a performer favoured by the state. He's the lead singer of Lube, which is often described as Putin's favourite band. And he's a vocal supporter of the Kremlin's policies, including the special military operation in Ukraine. Unlike Makarevich, Rostorguyev appears to have enjoyed easy access to Russia's best venues for years. On the 15th of March 2014, the day Andrei Makarevich was nearly beaten up by anti-Ukraine activists following a peace march in Moscow, Lube celebrated its 25th anniversary at the Russian capital's Olympic Stadium. The following day, it performed in Crimea in support of an internationally unrecognized vote used by the Kremlin to justify its annexation of the Ukrainian region. Rostorguyev and his band Lube have played at massive Kremlin-organized rallies held at Russia's largest stadium, Luzhniki, and also attended by President Putin.
Legendary group Lube!
In a sign of the band's influence, police reportedly forced visitors to a bar in Moscow to sing a Lube song during recent raids looking for pro-Ukrainian supporters. Nikolai Rostorguyev is subject to EU sanctions imposed for his role in what the European Council called the Kremlin's disinformation and information manipulation ecosystem. In Russia, numerous performers critical of the Kremlin, such as Andrei Makarevich, have been officially designated as foreign agents.
Vitaly Shevchenko. He was the subject of a massive manhunt involving thousands of police and roadblocks across vast swathes of India. For more than a month, the Sikh separatist leader Amritpal Singh evaded Indian security forces. Until now, that is. Police say they arrested him in a Sikh temple in a village in Punjab state. He's accused of attempted murder and has been detained under the National Security Act. The BBC's Arvind Chabra is in the city of Chandigarh in Punjab. Tim Franks asked him what more he knew about Amritpal Singh's arrest.
Punjab police has revealed this morning that they had special inputs that Amritpal Singh was hiding in a village in Moga district in the North Indian state of Punjab. He was hiding in a Gurudwara, which is a Sikh temple. They said that they did not enter the place because they wanted to maintain the sanctity of a religious place. When he found that there was no way he could escape and he had been surrounded, Amritpal Singh was arrested by the Punjab police. On the other hand, Amritpal Singh, he had released a video claiming that he has decided to surrender. This place, which is the Rode village, this is where Jarnail Singh Bhindranwale came from. Jarnail Singh Bhindranwale was a preacher who was accused by the government of India of leading an armed insurgency in the 1980s. And Jarnail Singh Bhindranwale is one person who Amritpal says that he draws a lot of inspiration from. In fact, some people even compare him with Jarnail Singh Bhindranwale.
Tell me a bit more about what he's being charged with, because or what he's being accused of.
There are many charges against Amritpal Singh. One particular incident took place when he, along with hundreds of armed supporters, stormed a police station to release one of his aides. So when that happened, many police personnel were also injured, including some senior police officers. They had lodged a case of attempt to murder.
Just how much support is there for a separate homeland for Sikhs?
Well, that's a very difficult question because there is no survey, there is no data as such. But if we go by what the support that he had, for instance, when he stormed the police station, there were hundreds of armed supporters. These kind of instances have been taking place. But back in 1980s and early years of 1990s, there was a full-fledged movement. I remember having interviewed Amritpal Singh a few weeks ago. He said that if the Hindus can demand a separate state, why can't Sikhs demand their own state as well? He came to India. He was in Dubai before that, while now he's a devout, practicing Sikh. But in the earlier pictures, he had his hair and beard neatly trimmed. So in fact, I asked him, how come these two different appearances? He said now he's a changed person. he's influenced by Sikhism, and he wants people of Punjab as well to be baptized and to shun drugs and to understand religion. Very articulate person, but very mysterious rise.
The BBC's Arvind Chabra in Chandigarh. Twitter has begun reinstating its famous blue ticks to accounts with over 1 million followers, even if they've not paid for a subscription to its premium service, Twitter Blue. Beyonce, Cristiano Ronaldo and Victoria Beckham, along with many others, have got the blue check mark back by their names. The BBC News Twitter account also has a verification badge once more without paying for it. Our tech editor Zoe Kleinman reports.
Before the billionaire Elon Musk purchased Twitter, the platform awarded a blue tick mark to accounts that it had verified itself as a badge of authenticity. It was designed to fight against misinformation. To retain the ticks, Mr. Musk had asked account holders to pay more than £6 a month for a premium service. On Thursday, all the ticks awarded for free under the old rules were removed. But what's happened this morning is that accounts with large followings have had them returned, despite owners saying they hadn't chosen to subscribe. Mr. Musk has so far remained uncharacteristically quiet about the change. He originally said he thought it was wrong for Twitter alone to decide which voices were more important, but this latest change suggests that perhaps he hasn't entirely levelled the playing field after all.
Zoe Kleinman. Some of the world's most famous runners took part in the London Marathon on Sunday. Over 45,000 people took part in the race. Kenya's Kelvin Kiptum won the elite men's race by running the second fastest marathon in history at 2 hours, 1 minute and 25 seconds.
So happy. I don't know what to say. I'm so grateful. The course was good, though a little bit of rain till towards halfway. I need to achieve much more, stay in athletics, be happy.
Meanwhile, in the elite women's race, Dutch Olympic champion Sifan Hassan pulled off an impressive performance to win in her debut marathon. The Ethiopian-born runner spoke to the BBC shortly after winning.
It is really amazing. I never thought I would finish the marathon, and here I am with one of my favourite marathons, and I win. I can't even believe it. It's so amazing crowd, and I was like, every single kilometre, I was so grateful.
Our correspondent, Charlotte Gallagher, was there.
I was at the start line and then I took two trains to get to the finish line, which sort of tells you how long the marathon is. It took us 40 minutes by public transport to get there. Obviously, people are having to run that distance. And as we were getting there, the first arrivals were getting in. So the elite wheelchair, they'd already arrived, but the men's elite racers and the women's elite racers were getting in. So we saw the winners and then obviously a huge cheer for Sir Mo Farah running his last ever marathon, essentially.
And he still came in ninth, wasn't it?
Yeah, London is his hometown as well. And he said that he wanted his last marathon to be in London. And he is one of those sports stars that people in the UK, even if they don't know much about sport, they know who Mo Farah is. So he got a huge reception as he was running down the Mall. And then you just see the physical exhaustion of the runners when they cross that finish line. Some of them collapse. Some of them are sick. They have to bring out stretchers for some. You realise how much people put their body through. When you see the elite runners, it's incredible because they are almost sprinting a marathon distance. And then after the elites came in, then you had people from running clubs. So they have normal jobs, but they're just incredible at running. And they weren't too far behind the elite racers. And then, of course, you have the mass participation. So people that are doing it for different charities, they're doing it for different people, celebrities, people in fancy dress. There was a man carrying a fridge who I spoke to before the event called Sam Hammond, and he was trying to break a world record for carrying a household appliance. Wow. The old record was 5 hours, 49 minutes and 37 seconds. He absolutely smashed it. He did it in 4 hours, 52 minutes and 10 seconds. So essentially took off a whole hour. And when I spoke to him, he'd never run a marathon distance before, let alone with a fridge. He was incredible. There was also a woman running in a pair of Wellington boots, trying to get the record for the fastest time. She broke that record. Adele Roberts, who's a BBC presenter, she had bowel cancer. She's recovered, but she has a stoma now. She was trying to break the world record for racing with a stoma. She broke that. So it was a 90-year-old as well, 9-0, running the London Marathon in person for the first time. He'd done the virtual marathons during the pandemic, but he was on the course for the first time.
I think I'd prefer Wellington boots to a fridge. Charlotte Gallagher with that report. We all have our own tactics to make a baby stop crying, but sumo wrestlers in Japan are well versed in the opposite. The ancient Naki Sumo Festival has returned for the first time since the pandemic. And there are no crying losers, as Anna Aslam reports.
For more than 400 years, the Naki Sumo Festival has taken place across Japan. And the rules vary from region to region. But the best-known event is held at the Sensoji Temple in Tokyo, where sumo wrestlers enter the open-air ring for a fight like no other. They hold babies, aged between 6 and 18 months, in front of each other and wait for them to start doing what babies do best. The first child to sob is declared the winner by a referee in an elaborate traditional uniform and blessed with good health. The wrestlers try to encourage crying by bouncing the baby in their arms, making loud noises or funny faces, and, if needed, using demon masks. If the babies start weeping at the same time, the louder cry wins. But the organizer Shigemi Fuji explained that it's all in good spirit.
Some people may be surprised to see this event and think it's terrible we make babies cry. But in Japan, we believe babies who cry powerfully grow up healthy.
This year, because of concerns about COVID, parents held their children in the ring rather than sumo wrestlers. Despite the rule change, they said they were glad to see the festival return after 4 years.
We heard that it's taking place this year, and we are happy that we can take part. Although our daughter doesn't cry much usually, she'll cry today and win a bout.
Rintaro Okamura's 8-month-old daughter was one of 64 babies who took part in the festival. We hope a good time was had by all.
Anna Aslam. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Shine, le compte qui libère le potentiel des pros, présente En Off, le podcast qui donne la parole aux entrepreneurs sur leur rapport à la santé mentale au travail. Sans tabou.
Il faut avoir une sacrée capacité à la joie. Parce qu'en fait, les parcours entrepreneuriaux, c'est pas des lignes droites, c'est des grandes sinusoïdes, de grands bonheurs et puis de grands doutes, de peur, de succès.
Envie de découvrir plus de témoignages ? Écoutez le podcast En Off, présenté par Shine, sur votre plateforme d'écoute préférée.
Bonjour, ceci est un message de la part d'Anna et Natacha, les co-animatrices du nouveau podcast Why I Move Dell UK, en association avec Nike. Nous faisons une pause dans notre vie quotidienne OL, à savoir, pour échanger avec d'incroyables femmes, des stars de cinéma et des icônes de mode, sur comment elles conjuguent quotidien très rempli et activités sportives. Mais aussi et surtout, sur comment cela les aide à se sentir mieux. Des entraîneurs et des formateurs Nike viendront également partager leurs conseils d'experts pour que notre pratique s'adapte à nous et à notre corps. Je me sens déjà mieux. Moi aussi. Why I Move, en association avec Nike, est à écouter maintenant.